President Donald Trump runs into tariff trouble, but the real impact of the policy is mostly felt by manufacturers, investors, and the American consumer. You're listening to SDPB's In the Moment. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Friday that President Donald Trump overstepped his authority in levying tariffs. Well, after admitting to being a bit panicked about tariffs months ago, Rick Kaler says the economic collapse that some pundits feared never did come to pass. What has unfolded, however, is the quieter impact on the American economy. That's something presidents try to shift blame for and calm investors strive to endure. Rick Kaler has written several books on financial therapy. He is a leader in the field internationally. He's founder of Kaler Financial in Rapid City. Here's our conversation. Take us back for people who need a reminder. The president of the United States wanted to raise tariffs across the board really drastically. For what? What was the goal of doing that as he stated it? And then let's talk about how it's kind of rolled out.
Yes, the goal was very much the goal in the 1930s or late 1920s, which was if we make foreign goods expensive enough, that will drive citizens to buy goods in the U.S. So it was a protectionist policy to force consumers to buy local, so to speak, and manufacturers to manufacture in the United States. So that was the stated goal.
And raise revenue.
And it raises revenue.
It can raise
a lot of revenue.
Yeah.
And the revenue raised is from the citizens of the country that establishes the tariffs.
Right.
So when the U.S. establishes a tariff, 87-88% of that is paid by U.S. companies. The other is paid by individual exporters and et cetera. I won't get into the weeds on that. But by and large, the tariffs are paid eventually by U.S. citizens or U.S. companies.
Which is why we call it a tax. Why we say, hey.
It's a tax.
It's a tax.
Pure and simple.
Yeah.
Totally a tax.
All right. So the sky didn't fall in the sense that there wasn't an economic collapse.
You had to go there, didn't you, Lori?
If you were waiting for an, well, you never said the sky was going to fall. You never said there would be an economic.
I was pretty turned over back in April.
Okay.
I mean, I was amongst the folks going, oh my God. And we were talking about 50%, 100%, right. 125%. And we were sitting at about 2 is where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And people like me kind of panicked. And so did the stock market, if you remember right.
Yeah.
The stock market tanked during that period of time with mm-hmm. fear. There was a lot of fear. And I think the fear was intellectually well-founded. But what happened was the tariffs were 100% today. 2 days from now, they're 20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was they were bouncing all around. And it took a while for the markets to assimilate what the new normal was. And the new normal was just because a tariff was announced that it was coming on didn't mean that it would come on.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of it. The other part cognitively made sense. Oh, if you put a tariff on today, you're not going to feel it today. You're not going to feel it in the economy today. It's going to take months to wash through.
Okay, it's been some months. Is it washing through? Because before we get too celebratory about, I think, $287 billion in customs, duties, taxes, and fees, what are the nuances of how it is playing out and who is paying for that money? Where do you want to begin with how do we say, okay, right now, with the snapshot of what we're looking at, what has the impact been?
Yes, so it is washing through. Right now, the average U.S. tariff is 17%. Now that's the highest since 1932. And prior to the 17%, we were at 2 or 3, give or take a percent in there, but it was really low. So our tariffs have gone up, let's just call it 7, 10 times what they were. And we're going to feel that because there's $287 billion that's now in the government treasury that used to be in the pockets of Americans. And that's this stealth tax. We don't see it, but we are experiencing higher prices. And you read that in the headlines all the time. Grocery prices seem to be higher. Things seem to be higher. And here you have a lot of good economic news. Jobs report is good. The stock market is doing well. And people, by and large, not happy. And I have to mention, Lori, that this is a little deja vu. We had the same thing happening under Biden.
I feel like we talked about this exact same thing, which was the economy was good under Biden, but everybody was talking about prices.
Yes,
And now
and there we are again.
with Trump, the tariffs are sort of working, but all of a sudden everybody's talking about affordability. And
Absolutely.
there are some real strong similarities there. It's almost as if the economy works. The rules of macroeconomics work regardless of who's in the White House and what your political party
Well,
is.
Laurie, what you say is so, there's a lot of truth to that because presidents think they control the economy more than they really do. I was listening to a talk show today where the host said hypocrisy is the rule. And it's the same with presidents. If the economy is good, they'll claim, that's because of me and all my policies. And if it's bad, that's because of the other party or the previous president.
And that's politics. The political goal is to get credit for anything positive, and the political goal is to transfer blame to the person who came before you. But let's set politics aside and go back to this idea about bringing manufacturing here. You're buying American, where you started from the beginning of like the 1930s, that part of the goal was to say these things should come. We want Americans to be buying American products. Is that happening? Are we seeing a return of manufacturing to American soil? And if we are, is that a good thing?
I would say to make a simple answer is no, it's not happening. One reason it's not happening is it takes 5 to 10 years to build a plant to start ramping up manufacturing. But let's go back to why, in the first place, why were we buying those foreign goods? We were buying those foreign goods because they were less expensive. Let's assume a playing field at the same quality. And the American consumer, typically given a choice of buying the same quality, cheaper or more expensive, will buy the less expensive product. And there's reasons behind that. And there's all sorts of reasons the country could be subsidizing those prices. There's a number of reasons why that may be true. But if we're going to force Americans to basically penalize them if they buy anything that's foreign, that means they're paying more. Pure and simple, they're paying more, and that's going to affect their pocketbooks. It's going to affect inflation. Without the tariffs, inflation would have been 0.7% lower. And when you look at that as a percentage, that's about 20, 25% lower. It doesn't sound like a whole lot. Okay, we're paying 0.7 more. But it's 20 to 25% higher prices we're paying, or that at least inflation is than what it could be.
So we are still feeling the crunch, and that is not your imagination. And you
It's
wrote.
not your imagination, and it's just this weird, what's going on? But Amazon, remember when Amazon was going to put on their receipts how much was in tariff? I was all for that because that's transparency, that's disclosure. The sales tax is that way. When you buy something, you see what you're paying in tax. But there's two taxes that are stealth, and one are tariffs, because you don't see it. And the second one are VAT taxes, which you encounter if you travel to, it will basically about almost any place outside of the US. Now, some of them have gotten to actually putting the tax on the receipt. So I love point of purchase disclosure. I love, let's be honest around finance, because if the average American sees what they're buying is 17% higher, now that's information that hits home right away. And
Information.
probably more people are, oh, I don't like those tariffs, which is the exact reason why a politician doesn't want them printed on the receipt, right? It's a stealth tax.
You also wrote a column about the weakening dollar, the American dollar, when you're overseas. If you travel, you might notice it in this way. And the panic that, or the emotional response that investors can have when all these things are happening that make them look away from stocks, bonds, real estate, some of the traditional investments to cryptocurrency or precious metals or what have you. Help us understand what's happening with emotional decision making under stress as investors try to escape uncertainty with their
Right.
portfolios.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the declining dollar, because I thought about it when I was telling you there's two taxes, and there's really, in a way, three. And that's when the dollar declines, which it's done. It's declined about 10% in the last year. The emotions that play into all of this, I mean, confusion can this sense something's wrong. And I don't know exactly what it is real, because where we don't have the facts, we don't have certitude, we just know something is off. And it's somewhat the same thing when we are investing. We would like certitude in our investing. We'd like to know the money's going to be there. We would like to know exactly how much am I going to make on this investment. And there's a high cost to that certitude. The high cost is, if I want that type of certitude, I put my money in the bank and I earn 2 or 3 or 4%. If I want to earn 6, 7, 8%, I need to be able to accept a lot of uncertainty, because now I'm into equities, I'm into stocks, and they can go up and down in a bear market. The stock market, on the average, falls 42%. Well, that could ruin your afternoon. We also have parts of us that are not very satisfied with a 5% return or a 10%. Not everybody. I know I used to have that. I want big returns. So I look at crypto, I look at gold, I look at various, places to put my money that are can be more speculative. Now, gold is an investment. Crypto is a speculation. It can be that part of us that wants to get rich quick. It can be that part of us that are just bored with investing, and we ought to be bored with investing. If you're not bored, then you're probably not investing. Now, that's in general, not on any specific day or specific month.
You're gambling, yeah, and
But when
not
you have
investing.
crypto and you got Bitcoin going from 120,000 to 60,000 in what, a week or 2 weeks, that's not a currency. That's just an outright speculation. And I know there's many folks that would disagree with me, especially younger, that believe that crypto is part of your should be part of your asset allocation. I don't think we're there yet. A lot of money's been made, and even more money's been lost on
Sure.
crypto.
Noted. If you're impatient, bored, you want it to go faster than it is going, if you want to outrun this inflation, the sort of unease that you feel about prices and affordability right now, and if you want to escape that uncertainty, now is a good time to remind everyone that this is part of the process. This is part of investing, is that slow, thoughtful practice that's not tied to your ups and downs of emotion, where at noon you might feel one way and at 2:30 you might feel a different way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that can get us into a lot of trouble. And in a lot of cases, what we're talking about is anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's the anxiety that says FOMO, fear of missing out. Anxiety building, 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 building. Oh my God, Bitcoin's at 100,000. I need to get in. I need to get in. Or the market, or put any gold, put anything in there. And then the fear of when it's falling. That, oh no, this is going to zero. I better get out while I can.
Right.
And it's just a cycle there. Just repeats, and we just get whipsawed emotionally on it, and it costs us a lot of money. And so it's learning to sit with the anxiety and say, okay, yeah. And this is where I like the IFS and the parts work, is realizing a part of me is freaking out. Part of me wants to either buy or sell whatever is the wrong thing at that time, thinking it's the right thing, and being able to understand that part, to connect. Yeah, you're scared to death. I get it. I get your story. And that can almost settle the emotions, just realizing I am scared. And Lori, that's so hard for a lot of people to know what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. I'm one who didn't used to know what I was feeling.
Yeah.
When typically when I ask somebody, so what are you feeling? They'll give me a thought. Da la 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 la. I feel that the markets are da 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 da. And it took me a lot of money to be able to get that down to one word. What am I feeling right now? Scared.
Yeah.
And that can be one of the biggest payoffs a person has in investing, is to be able to know what you're feeling, able to say it, able to own it, and the feeling will disseminate, it will relax, and you can say, and I'm not going to sell.
I want to, if you're willing, to go a little further into this idea of facing your own emotions, or even looking at what decisions somebody else that you care about has made, and saying, why on earth is that person so bad with money? Or why on earth is this happening to me again and again, if you're making financial missteps, for example? And you wrote about the real financial cost of childhood trauma. I thought that was just such an interesting way to look at childhood trauma and say, it's expensive.
Absolutely.
What kind of childhood experiences are we talking about here?
Man, you can be talking about almost any childhood experience, and let me frame that. You've got the big T trauma. A parent died, a parent became disabled, just terrible, terrible things. Mm-hmm. That's what I used to think trauma was. You've also got little T trauma. That's being criticized. Okay, the little T trauma, if it happens once, if it happens twice, if it happens three times, is not going to traumatize a person. But it's death by a thousand cuts.
Sure.
If a person lives in a sea of criticism, is raised in that, is in that for 10 years, this will become complex, what they call complex trauma, and will have the same impact as a big T trauma. And in some cases, they found more. So It's hard to say exactly this was traumatic, this wasn't, because the trauma isn't what happened. It's how we frame it, how we receive it.
Sure.
Anything can be traumatic, especially to a child that has no frame, especially if there's no parent there making sense of what's happening. So in the research that you just referred to, they use something called the ACE. And it's a test to determine if you have childhood trauma. And I believe in a score over 23 or 24 indicates, yeah, you did. And what they did was find that anybody that scored positive on childhood trauma that their net worth as an adult was 25 to 45% less. Now, that means for every $1 million you could potentially accumulate, you would accumulate $250,000 to $450,000 less. Now, I intuitively knew that trauma is costly. I didn't have this type of research and dollars to ascribe to it. And first thought I had when I heard that is I should raise my rates. That's huge.
Right.
That is huge. And to your question about when I see these behaviors in others, these I will call them illogical behaviors around money, or I see illogical behaviors in myself. That's a trailhead. That's the beginning of a path we could go down to perhaps discover something. That could be a sign of childhood trauma. Isn't necessarily, but here's what we know. Every illogical behavior we have around money, regardless of what we think about it or someone else thinks about it, regardless how illogical it seems, makes perfect sense. Every illogical behavior makes perfect sense when we understand the underlying belief system.
Right.
And we could add any underlying trauma.
Could be emotionally rational.
You connect those dots and you're like, yeah, no wonder. No wonder you got to spend everything that comes into your checking account. No wonder you feel so much anxiety and just fill in the blank.
Yeah.
It all makes sense.
Right. If your parents, I think that one of the examples was, someone who earned something and came home and her, mother would have just taken that money. Of course, when she earns something, she just spends it so that it can't be taken from her. That makes perfect sense. Why would you bring home your tips that you worked hard for so that it could be taken without your permission or consent to be used in a wasteful way? You're not feeling like you're contributing to the household. You feel like you're just being
Exactly.
taken advantage of. So, of course, when you grew up, you would take that money and put it somewhere that you
Spend
felt
it.
was safer. In this
You
case,
put it into something that you can enjoy.
yeah, shoes,
Because
yeah, or what
think
have
about
you.
the violation that a kid feels
Right,
with
right.
that.
Yeah.
And protective parts of ourselves say, we're never feeling that
Yeah,
again.
yeah.
And therefore, we will never save again because saving is going to take us right back to that feeling of being violated.
Right.
If I spend it, I've got at least I have something to show for it.
The good news is this is unaddressed childhood trauma. These adverse childhood experiences that are unhealed create this kind of financial impact, and therefore, investment in the therapy or the work or the healing of these traumas, especially when it comes, intersects with money, can have an outsized influence then on bringing you back to a healthier financial place. So it can be a good thing if you can harness and make an investment toward your future.
Yes, they're all fixable. They're all healable. Now that may not be overnight, and that may not be with a bill, but they are when a person has the courage to go within and hear the stories and find out what's going on. And I really want to underscore that it takes a ton of courage to do this inner work, to go to those places, because there's a good reason. There's coping parts of us that have walled those parts off because they are painful. And to open that door and go back into it takes a lot of courage. But the reward is phenomenal. It's calm, serenity, confidence, you know. There's a huge reward there.
Talk about compassion versus shame. As you mentioned, sort of the noticing, the curiosity. you know, standing at the trailhead and saying, I wonder what this might mean. You know, we've talked about the research, you know, directly into adverse childhood experiences or the ACEs. But where does compassion come into play in the healing process?
It's huge. It is huge. Shame can just shut us down. To heal, we need to be in a place that is safe. Mm-hmm. We need to be in a place, certainly, where there's no external shaming coming. We got two types of shame, external shame and internal shame, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's the internal shame that can really hurt us. And the one thing that I will say about IFS, internal family systems, after about 3 years of doing that myself, I told the founder one time, the biggest area I have seen turn around in me is my self-criticism. Of all the things I've tried, IFS helped me to understand what my self-criticism was attempting to do. And it was really a good intention. It was really trying to save me from more criticism by, hey, here's what you need to be doing, do it. Because this is the only tool I know, speaking as the critical part, this is the only tool I know to keep you from re-entering this pain. And once we can understand the good intention of that part, once we can use some tools to help that part relax, not shame it, not get rid of it, magic can happen.
Something can take years. The process can be long, but the process, I think you've also seen, can be pretty quick as well. If somebody comes to a realization, makes a connection and goes, oh, that's not so scary after all. Have you seen it go really fast at times where people have made significant financial changes or changes to their financial life because they just realized, oh, that's what 8-year-old me is telling me, but this isn't, I'm not 8 anymore.
That when that connection is hit, when that deep aha is hit, you know, I've seen people go from saving zero to 3,000 a month to 7,000 a month. In certain cases, not that everything's about saving money.
Right.
But that's when permanent behavioral change happens, is when we see at a deep level, we get those ahas, and things can really fall in place. Now, it can take, you know, it can take hours to years to get to that place. But it can happen very quickly when all the dots connect.
Rick Kaler is a financial therapist and wealth advisor. He founded Kaler Financial in Rapid City, and he is known as an international leader in the field of financial therapy. That's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.